Hello, and welcome to March 2024 with the Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. First, a huge thank you to all my wonderful patrons. We have a couple of new ones in the last little bit, and I'm so grateful to have you with me. I also want to say we have some great episodes coming up, celebrating women in history and women's leadership, something so dear to my heart. I'm trying to do all the speaking about leadership and women's leadership I can. Now, the ebook Royals, Rebels, and Romantics in Love is now available. You can get it from my website or email me, carolanne@carolannloyd.com. Getting a new website, so if it's not quite ready, you can email me and then you don't have to wait. I'm so excited. There's been great response to the idea of tea and talk. And I will tell you, New York is ahead of the game and already asking for some dates. So we will be coming to New York and other places soon. Just let me know where you are and if you would like us to bring tea and talk to you. Just tell me where you are. Anyway, stay tuned because another wonderful episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics is coming up now. Welcome, everyone. I am thrilled to be here with esteemed author and historian Sharon Bennett Connolly, who just does such an amazing job of bringing periods of history we may not know so much about to life. So welcome, Sharon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thanks for having me.
Well, now you have written some wonderful books about the women in history, and whether it's women during a period of time, the Magna Carta, now the anarchy, specific women like Nicola DeHaye, why is it so important for you to focus on these women and the women's experiences and the women's voices?
Well, it started when I realized that there was all these groups on Facebook dedicated to different kings, in English kings mainly, but dedicated to different kings and different rulers, but not to any of the women. And I suddenly realized that there's this real lack of information about not just queens, but about women in history. And now I have been accused of changing history because I'm writing about women and they're doing things that nobody's heard of before. So I'm obviously changing history rather than actually recording history. But my argument is I'm putting the women back into history. Until now, we've read about 50% of the history. We've read about the men, the battles, the wars, the politics, but we never read about the women. So, but until you put, women are 50% of the population. Until you put them back into the history, you don't have the whole history. So putting them back in, you're now looking at history as a whole thing. When I write about women in history, the books are called, yes, Ladies of Magna Carta, Women of the Anarchy. But in the introductions to each of those, I put that I'm not looking at the women in isolation. The men's stories are still there, but I'm just focusing on the women. But I'm not ignoring King Stephen or King John. Their stories are still there. It's just putting the women back into where they were. You know, they've basically been written out for generations. Well, now we're writing them back in, and I'm not the only one doing it. But there's another side of it as well. This I only realized a little while ago when I was on Twitter. And a history teacher put up his reading list for the next term for the students. And there was one female author in a list of 10 books. And he unfollowed me because I called him out on it and said, how can you expect the girls in your class to be interested in history if you don't show them that they have, that women can be interested in history, that they have an involvement in it? And he unfollowed me, but I still stand by it. I think that, you know, if you're picking history books, you should pick 50% male authored books and 50% female authored books, and you're showing boys the girls do history and you're showing girls the girls do history, and that,
right,
you know, they all have an interest in it.
Yes, and we all have something to learn, and we all have something to say.
Yes.
The women have something to say, the women who are in the history, and you're helping us see what they have to say, and women writing about history.
Yes.
And women historians have something to say, and it might be a slightly different perspective, but it's really important. The way we think and we write and we speak about history really shapes our understanding.
It really
and so
is.
That's
And we
important.
really need that female perspective, not just on women's history, but on history as a whole. We all, our brains work differently. We know that. So women can see something different to the way men can. But that makes it the bigger picture, a better picture. You can see, you know, everybody has something to contribute and something invested in history. So we should encourage both sides, not just, you know, go for the male authors. No, go for male and female. Go for each.
Right. And as you say, put books by authors who are male and female, put books by everybody on the list, and books about everybody on the list, so that we get this larger and richer picture that there were all kinds of people, and we've only seen a slice of it up till now in some cases.
And we get a balance. And I mean, we all talk about equal opportunities these days. Well, we have to show the girls and the boys in schools that there are equal opportunities, that no matter what sex you are, you can be a historian and you can write about whatever history you want. You know, I was telling some kids in a school a few weeks ago, the one thing about history is it covers every subject. You can write about the history of science, the history of mathematics, the history of drama. So there's something in history for everybody.
Right. And the history of sports and the history of, games and all kinds of things. So that's great. So thank you, because I think it is important, and it is something that we need to continue to self-consciously do and take these steps like you did in the school, which is great. So thank you for that. Now, in this book, and you have so many wonderful books. Right now, we're talking about the women of the anarchy. So you have these incredibly strong women. Interestingly, both named Matilda, which just can be a little confusing, but we have the Empress Matilda and the Queen Matilda, and we'll talk about both of them. And they are also both descendants of Queen Margaret of Scotland. So you have this matriarchy and this strong women. And yet I think these stories are so seldom told about these women. We always hear about William the Conqueror, and we hear about the sons, and then we hear about Henry II. He just kind of emerges out of nowhere. And, you know, there's just sort of this gap of all these women. And so why are they so overlooked?
I don't know. The anarchy itself, I mean, we do call it the anarchy, but most of the time it's referred to as the period known as the anarchy. It doesn't really, it's like they're still trying to decide what to name it.
That's funny too,
It's confusion. And like you say, it's just after the conquest, and it's before the rise of the Plantagenets. So it's this little in-between period that most of the time does get ignored. You know, I think there's Cadfael, the Ellis Peters' books are set in the anarchy, and there's Sharon Penman's book, When Christ and His Saints Slept, and I think Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth. But there's few other novels set in the anarchy, and there's not a lot written about it in general, except the chroniclers all wrote about it, but actual historians seem to shy away from it. There's a brilliant book by Matthew Lewis, which was written just before I wrote Women of the Anarchy, and that is Stephen and Matilda. And that's very good. And there are a few, but there's most of them concentrate on Stephen. You know, there are more books about King Stephen than there are about Empress Matilda. There are a couple about Matilda. Marjorie Chibnall's the go-to book, and Catherine Hanley's written a brilliant book about Empress Matilda. But they're the only two I can think of. Whereas I could name about half a dozen on King Stephen. So it is, I think we're still trying to get away from the patriarchal attitude to history, which doesn't help. But It's like you say, the anarchy. There's a period in the anarchy. I keep telling everyone this because I was so amazed when I discovered it. 1141, this one year. And in a few of the history books, it is actually called the War of the Two Matildas. That year is the only year in English history and possibly in European history where women are at the head of both armies. And that was a real revelation for me because I'm there thinking, there's this period where women are the ones doing the leading, and yet no one mentions
So tell us
it.
about, because that moment, tell us how we get to that year and that moment when Queen Matilda and Empress Matilda are in fact leading their armies. So how does that happen? Who are they and how does that happen?
Empress Matilda is the daughter of Henry I and Matilda of Scotland, and she's the granddaughter of Saint Margaret. Matilda of Boulogne, also Queen Matilda, Stephen's wife, is the daughter of Mary of Scotland and the granddaughter of Saint Margaret. And King Stephen is the son of Adela of Normandy, and therefore the grandson of Matilda of Flanders, just like Empress Matilda. So you know how they say that the Wars of the Roses is the cousins' war? The anarchy is the cousins' war. These all three, they were first cousins. Empress Matilda was first cousin to both Stephen and his wife. So this was a real family dispute. I think Henry I probably saw Stephen as a potential successor after his son died in the White Ship disaster. Empress Matilda was in Germany and expected to spend her life in Germany. So Henry probably started grooming Stephen to take the throne. Then, when Empress Matilda's husband died in 1125, she was recalled to England, and Henry made all the barons swear to uphold her claim to the throne. And he thought he can actually have his blood on the throne by giving it to Empress Matilda. So probably put Stephen's nose out of joint a little bit. But then when Henry I died, Empress Matilda had just a few months before given birth to her second son, Geoffrey, and almost died in the process. And by December 1135, she just discovered she was pregnant again. So there was no way she could travel. Henry died on the 1st of December 1135. Stephen was probably in Boulogne at the time, and I think had been doing a few deals in the lead up to Henry's death. And the first thing he did was take ship to England, secure the treasury at Winchester, and get himself crowned at Westminster Abbey on the 22nd of December. So within 3 weeks of Henry I dying, and it probably took a couple of days before he heard that Henry I had died, he
He
was
was
King of
ready.
England. Yeah, it was quite a coup. I think he was well ready. He'd married Matilda of Boulogne, who was, they were a powerful seafaring nation, very big merchant county. And he had all her resources at his disposal and probably her backing. She was not the quiet little woman at home. She'd been raised to rule Boulogne in her own name. So when you look at the charters from Boulogne, they're all in Stephen and Matilda's name, not just Stephen's name. Everything's done with his wife at his side. So I think he probably went to her one day and said, I think I should have the throne of England. And she probably said, yeah, go for it. Let's do it. So Stephen takes the throne, and poor Empress Matilda has to wait until she's given birth in 1136 before she can do anything. And by that point, the coup is complete. All the barons in England, except one, have sworn to Stephen, including Empress Matilda's illegitimate half brother, Robert, Earl of Gloucester. So she probably thought her cause was lost, although her husband, Geoffrey of Anjou, who none of the English liked, still thought he could at least take Normandy. And he starts this campaign to take Normandy, which carries on until he's taken Normandy. He was right, he could take Normandy. But a lot of the barons, a lot of the arguments against Empress Matilda is that she was married to Geoffrey of Anjou, and the English didn't like the idea that Geoffrey would be ruling England in her name. despite the fact that the oath that Henry made his barons swear were to Matilda, that she would rule, not Geoffrey. Well, you have this anomaly where she's the woman, so her husband is the one who would technically rule. And a lot of historians who claim it wasn't because she was a woman that they didn't like, that they didn't like the idea of Empress Matilda ruling, use the argument that it was because of her husband. And it's like, but that's still because she was a woman, because her brother William was married to Matilda of Anjou, Geoffrey's sister. But you never saw anything in the 11 teens saying that the barons did not like the idea of William being married to Matilda of Anjou. It was because she was a woman married to Geoffrey. So that's that argument put to bed as far as I'm concerned. But a lot of the time it's, you know, she was a woman. She couldn't rule. She couldn't lead an army. But I think the most powerful, the strongest two people in England at that time were Empress Matilda and Matilda of Boulogne. Because if it wasn't for Matilda of Boulogne, who had supported Stephen in his claim for the throne, and then 1141, 2nd of February 1141, the Battle of Lincoln is fought, and Stephen is captured and sent to imprisonment at Bristol Castle. If his wife hadn't been as strong as she was, he would have stayed imprisoned in Bristol Castle for the rest of his life. I mean, Henry I had kept his brother in prison for 35 years. So, you know, the Normans knew a thing or two about keeping people locked up. But Matilda of Boulogne continued the fight. And this is where we get the War of the Two Matildas, where Empress Matilda is trying to get to London to get herself crowned. And Queen Matilda brings up an army to chase her out of London before she can be crowned. In fact, before she's finished her evening meal, apparently they had to flee so quickly, they had to leave their dinner on its plates. And then they have this battle at Winchester called the Rout of Winchester in the August of 1141, where Empress Matilda is almost surrounded by Queen Matilda's forces and has to flee west because it's literally the only route open to her. The rest is blockaded by Queen Matilda. Unfortunately, in the rout, her brother leads the rear guard to make sure the Empress gets away and gets himself captured. So now Empress Matilda has got Stephen in her clutches, but Queen Matilda has got Robert in her clutches, and Robert is the Empress's leading general. She needs him back to continue the fight. So they have to do this prisoner exchange. They have to swap, despite the fact Robert wasn't keen on the swap because he said he was only an earl and wasn't worth the value of a king in Stephen. They did do this prisoner swap where the Empress gets Robert back and Matilda of Boulogne gets Stephen back. So what you have by the end of the year 1141, everyone's back where they started. Empress Matilda got this close to the throne, but Stephen's the one who at Christmas 1141 is still sat on it, wearing his crown in Canterbury Cathedral with his queen by his side. And the only reason he's there is because his queen kept the fight going.
Yes, and that is a perfect example of the way these women were leading. They were absolutely the leaders, making the decisions, deciding on the prisoner swap, leading the resistance and the lead. And yet, you're right, that should be a fantastic lesson in history, and we just don't hear about it very often. So thank you. Now, tell us, because researching this period of time, and you've mentioned the chronicles, but how do you find things out? Because there tends to be some legends that grow up and rumors that get started about, it seems like, women in particular. And how do you do the research combating sort of the way we've come to hear about and think about some of these characters?
Yeah, well, it is hard. I mean, you have to look. The thing to keep in mind, whichever chronicle you're reading, is whose side were they on? Because there's the Gesta Stefani, which is obviously is the is the jest of King Stephen, so the deeds of Stephen. So it's on Stephen's side. And you can tell how biased this book is. It refuses to call Matilda Empress Matilda. It calls her the Countess of Anjou all the way through. Never gives her the title of Empress. She's married to Geoffrey of Anjou, so she's the Countess. And so they're trying to belittle her, because if they actually said she was the Empress, you know, they'd be giving her too much rank if she was Empress. So, you know, we'll keep calling her the Countess and belittle her. And you've got the William of Malmesbury, whose patron is Robert of Gloucester. So he's more friendly towards Empress Matilda, but his priority is not Empress Matilda, it's telling Robert of Gloucester's story. So it bigs up Robert of Gloucester, it's kind to Empress Matilda. And it's just things like that. You have to read between the lines, see where each, whose side they're on. But you also have to be aware that they don't all agree. Because you have these instances, like the Battle of Lincoln is a good example. Henry of Huntingdon and Ordric Vitalis both describe the Battle of Lincoln. One of them says Stephen's sword broke, so he drew his axe. And the other one says Stephen's axe broke, so he drew his sword. And it's like, I have no clue which one's right. But they can't agree. And then you have this thing in 1142 where Empress Matilda makes this fantastic escape from Oxford Castle. The castle's surrounded by Stephen's troops in winter time. It's snow on the ground. There's blizzards everywhere, and they're running out of food in the castle, and they need to surrender. They surrender, they won't be killed, and they need to surrender, but they can't surrender while the Empress is still in residence, so they have to get her out. One of the chroniclers has her being lowered from the keep by a rope, and the other one has her escaping through a postern gate. And I was asked the other day, which one's true? And I'm like, I don't know. You know? Both are great stories. And luckily, I don't have to decide. I'm not writing a novel where I have to have one strain of story and that's it. So I can put both stories in and say it's up to the reader to decide which one they prefer. The magnificent bit about it is she's dressed in white and she actually walks through Stephen's camped army. In this snowstorm, they're oblivious to her walking between tents and between the men, then walking across the frozen River Thames to get to escape to Wallingford. And it's just like the courage of this woman is incredible.
Well, that's really true. And that's a wonderful example of a courage that defies some of the other descriptions that are so much putting her down, like she's only a countess and putting her down. When you see the steps she actually takes to escape, because that's the only way her quest for the throne can continue. If she's there and surrenders, it's over. So she's continuing that quest, knowing that she has been brought up and prepared to rule, and there's no reason why she can't. And Queen Matilda also believes that she and Stephen, and she herself, you know, she doesn't surrender when her husband's captured.
No.
She shows an extraordinary amount of courage. Now, both at this time, both Matilda, so her first husband, the emperor, has died. So now she's married to Geoffrey of Anjou, and Queen Matilda is married to Stephen. So what do we know about the relationships between the husband and wife in both cases? So we know that Stephen really relies on Queen Matilda. What do we know about Empress Matilda and Geoffrey? And do we know more about King Stephen and Queen Matilda?
Stephen and Queen Matilda, I think they seem to have had very much a partnership in their marriage. You know, he was the man who had the claim to the English throne, who could become king. She was the woman, she was the person who had the resources to make that happen for him. You know, she had an entire, a very rich county at her disposal to make it happen for him. So it was a match made in heaven as far as Stephen was concerned, definitely. Empress Matilda and Geoffrey of Anjou is a totally different matter. She was, 25, 26 when she was married to Geoffrey. He was 14. And, you know, she'd been married to a man older than herself previously, and suddenly she was married to a boy who, yes, he'd been given the County of Anjou by his dad, who'd resigned it and gone off to become King of Jerusalem. But he was still only a boy, and he very much, apparently he was very handsome. But I think at 25, can you imagine being made to marry a 14-year-old? He was probably very much up himself at that time as well. You know, he's a teenage boy, for Pete's sake. So I can understand why she was reluctant to marry him and why the marriage didn't get off to a good start. Within a year of the marriage, she was back at her father's court, refusing to go back to her husband. They did eventually reconcile, and they had three children together, all boys. And I think they did manage to make a partnership in that their aim wasn't to be happy together. It was to guarantee the future of their eldest son, Henry. And Geoffrey fights in Normandy and continues to fight in Normandy until he's taken it. And then he hands it to Henry to make Henry Duke of Normandy. And in 1142, after Empress Matilda's escape from Oxford, when her brother Robert had been to Geoffrey to ask him for reinforcements, and Geoffrey had prevaricated for a while he and Robert took, I think it was 8 castles in Normandy, before he actually refused to give Robert any reinforcements. But when Robert came back to England, he didn't bring the reinforcements, but he brought Henry. And it was the first time Matilda had seen her son in 4 years. Henry was a teenager now. He was installed in Bristol Castle and continued his education with Robert of Gloucester's son, and learned what about England. Whereas, you know, when he was in Anjou, he'd have been learning about Normandy and Anjou, ruling Anjou. When he came to England, he learned about England. And you see this gradual focus with Empress Matilda, where she's changing the focus from her claiming the throne to securing the throne for Henry. And she's got Henry there now. She can show him to the barons and say, this is who you're fighting for. Yes, it's my throne, but it will be his eventually. And he is the grandson of Henry I. He's not the great grandson of William the Conqueror, like Stephen's son is. He's the grandson of Henry I, your last king. And it's his blood that should be on the throne. So you see this focus. And I think this was one thing that Empress Matilda learnt from Matilda of Boulogne. Because when Stephen was captured, Matilda of Boulogne made a great deal of effort in negotiating with Empress Matilda to secure the rights of her son Eustace to inherit the County of Boulogne and Stephen's County of Eye. And, you know, she was trying to make sure that his inheritance didn't suffer because his father was the captured king. And I think Empress Matilda learned a lot from that and realised that nobody was going to accept her because she was a woman. Or nobody could gainsay the idea of Henry succeeding his grandfather as King of England. It was his throne by right.
Yes, and one of the things I appreciate about Henry as he begins to emerge as, you know, we're fighting now for Henry, is he takes on the name or the title Henry Fitz Empress.
Yes.
So he is associating himself, that Fitz meaning son of, so he is associating himself with Matilda. I mean, I think he's really demonstrating that allegiance to her. Typically, the son would take his father's moniker, not his mother's, but he does take, you know, take on Henry Fitz Empress and is fighting through her line and through her claim.
Yeah, because that's where his inheritance to the English crown comes from.
Right.
So he wants to highlight that and make sure that everybody knows that the throne was hers and then his.
Yes. Yes.
And yeah, it's very much, it's a nice awakening to see with Empress Matilda. It's sad, really, to think that she suddenly realised they're never going to give it to me. But
yeah.
I've got to carry on fighting. She couldn't give up. She had to carry on fighting to guarantee Henry's succession. And you see, in the early 1150s, Matilda of Boulogne, Stephen's wife, is very active in trying to get their eldest son, Eustace, crowned during Stephen's lifetime to guarantee Eustace's succession to the English throne. And they have to ask the Pope's permission, and the Pope refuses. And that's a big signal to every baron in England that the Pope doesn't think that the Pope saw Stephen as a caretaker for the throne. That, yes, he was the most eligible man present available in 1135, but it wasn't his to keep. And it certainly wasn't his to pass on to his son Eustace. So the Pope refusing it shows all the barons in England that the Pope thinks Henry should be king after Stephen. And then you get in 1153 this treaty between Stephen and Henry. Eustace dies, unfortunately not. Nobody likes Eustace. He dies after raiding a couple of monasteries. And so the way is set for Stephen to adopt Henry and pass the throne onto Henry. Effectively disinheriting his youngest, Stephen's youngest son, William, who's sort of appeased with land and a very good marriage. But it's you do get this idea that Stephen, by this point, Queen Matilda died in 1152, so Eustace has died, and Stephen's like probably wishing he'd never took the throne in the first place because it's been nothing but trouble. So he suddenly sets out this appeasement scheme where Henry will succeed him, but he gets to live out his life as king.
Well, and I think that's interesting. It's after Queen Matilda's gone,
yes,
that he feels this way. I mean, she really does seem to be a lot of the fire for that during a period of time. So now we have the fairly peaceful end to this, because they're not fighting anymore. Stephen does stay on the throne, and at his death, quite peacefully, Henry takes the throne.
Yes.
Empress Matilda is still alive.
She is, yes. She retired to Normandy in 1148. Her brother, Robert of Gloucester, died in 1147. So she lost her leading general in 1147. And Henry started taking up more and more responsibility in the fight, supported by his uncle, King David of Scots, who had always been on Empress Matilda's side, despite the fact Empress Matilda and Queen Matilda were both his nieces. It was Empress Matilda he supported. Although that was probably more because more trouble in England have, the safer Scotland is. So it was in his best interest to keep the fight going. But yeah, he's supporting, he knights Henry FitzEmperors and then supports Henry's battles for the throne. And Matilda goes to Normandy, and she basically rules Normandy as regent for Henry. While he's in England, she's controlling Normandy. And you see, even through, once he's King of England, he seeks his mum's advice. When you have the problem with Becket in 1170, there are letters from Empress Matilda to Henry telling him to sort it out, to find the middle way. And both Empress Matilda and Eleanor of Aquitaine, Henry's wife, are acting as mediators between Henry and Becket. So she was very much, she showed, even after she'd failed to claim the throne, that she had a very politically astute mind, and Henry made good use of it. He knew what his mum was capable of.
Yes, and it's very interesting to me that by the time he's king, he has his mother, Empress Matilda, who is completely capable of ruling and doing all kinds of things. And he's married to Eleanor of Aquitaine, who has also been queen consort of France and has arranged the marriage. And so he has these two very strong women in his life. Yeah. That might have been an interesting family dinner if they were all gathered around to chat about what we should do next. But it is a time where these just terrific women are playing such a key role.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were able to suggest to your readers one thing you would like them to take away, now there's so many things to take away from the book, but one thing you would really like them to take away from this book, what would that be?
To make your own judgment about these women, to reassess them and to not just accept that Empress Matilda was haughty and bossy. That's the image you get for, you know, everybody says, oh, she was haughty and bossy and she just upset everybody. And it's like, don't take it as that, because those observations are exaggerated to make her look like that. She had her men, her people were loyal to her. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason her brother fought to put her on the throne for 10 years, you know, and there's a reason that Baldwin de Redvers and all the others supported her. She had a right to the throne, but she kept their loyalty.
Yes.
And Queen Matilda, she needs to be brought out of the background, because she is often just ignored because everyone talks about Stephen. And it's like, I don't think there would have been a King Stephen if there wasn't a Matilda of Boulogne.
Right. So in both cases, just see them for who they are.
Yeah.
Not for the ways that some of the, you know, people write with an agenda a lot of the time.
They do.
And certainly then too. Well, thank you. Now, I know you have some amazing new projects going on. So give us just a taste of some of the other things coming soon from you.
Coming soon. Women of the Anarchy comes out in the States in April.
Mm-hmm.
And then in June in the UK, and probably about 6 months later in the States, I have Heroines of the Tudor World.
I can't wait for that.
It's my first sequel. My first book was Heroines of the Medieval World. And I had in mind then that I might do a Tudor one as well, but I wasn't sure I'd be able to. And I suggested it to my publisher and he said, oh yes, go for it. So it's the chapter titles are the same as the Heroines of the Medieval World. So they're still warrior heroines. Instead of the medieval ideal, there's the Tudor ideal. And there's the last chapter is the survivors, the women who made it through all the dangers. And it was just really interesting to do a project where I knew where I was going, because I had the same chapters that I'd done with Heroines of the Medieval World. I just had to do it with Tudor women. But the problem was trying not to have the entire focus on the wives of Henry VIII. So they are in there, but they're not necessarily in their own story. Like Catherine Howard is in there as part of the story for Jane Boleyn. Anne Boleyn is there as part of the story for Mary Boleyn. So they're all in there, but not necessarily in their own stories. And
right.
It's very interesting to actually do that. And look, it's my first Tudor book. Well, it was great fun. And there's so much information on the Tudors. It was so much easier to find all the information than it is about Women of the Anarchy. You don't have to scour the chronicles for just one mention. They're everywhere.
Right. So that must have been in some way, although sometimes there's so much, again, you don't know what all to keep. And then people were also writing with agendas. And so you see people described by different writers in different ways. So that's really great. And I'll just remind the US listeners that we don't always have to wait a full 6 months. There are ways of getting those books once they're published in Britain. So that's really exciting. And then What else is coming up, or what else are you working on?
Then in January, the book I've just finished writing will be out, and that's Scotland's Medieval Queens. And I'm immensely proud of that book. It's longer than it was supposed to be, but I knew about Scotland's history. I'm a big fan of Robert the Bruce. So I knew a lot about Scotland's history, but not about its queens. And this book is an the inspiration of my son. He came out of English one day when he was doing his GCSEs, and they'd been studying Macbeth. And he came out and said, "Mum, you need to set the record straight about Lady Macbeth. Shakespeare has not been fair to her." And I was like, "All right." I says, "Well, he wasn't fair to Richard III." He says, "Yes, but nobody's bothered about Macbeth's wife. Everybody's bothered about Richard III." I said, "That's true." I said, "Actually, Lewis, that's not a bad idea." And so that was Scotland's Medieval Queens. It's actually titled Scotland's Medieval Queens, from St. Margaret to Margaret of Denmark. But Lady Macbeth, Gruach, I gave her name. Shakespeare doesn't even give her name. She is in the preface, in the prologue, so that she gets a full representation and
Oh, wonderful.
hopefully rehabilitated.
Well, and when we read that, we can all think of your son inspiring you, because that's a great part of the story, right? Well, that is wonderful. And I will have all of these, but tell us where we can find you to hear everything you're doing, your history, the interesting bits, and all of that. Tell us
Yep,
everything that
I
you've
have
got.
a blog, History of the Interesting Bits. I have a Facebook page, which is also History of the Interesting Bits, or my own Sharon Bennett Connolly. I'm on Twitter at the History Bits. Sharon Bennett Connolly on Threads. I'm on Blue Sky as well, and LinkedIn. And I have my own podcast, A Slice of Medieval, that I co-host with Derek Burks, which is great fun. So, yeah, I think that's everything.
Well, I will have all these links in the show notes. So don't worry if you didn't write them all down. Don't worry, they'll be there. But I just wanted you to hear there are lots of places to find Sharon and keep up with all the wonderful work that she is doing. So thank you so much for coming on. It's always such a treat for me to get to talk with you and
Oh, and me
hear.
too, Caroline. One
It's
day we will meet in person, I tell
that's
you.
right. That's we're determined. We're determined to do
Yes.
that. But for now, thank you for coming on and really bringing to light these women and their stories that are so interesting. And you can see they are so exciting. And imagine a woman all in white walking through this blizzard, and the men around her don't even see her. I mean, that's just crying out for more attention. And a year that both the leaders of these armies are women, you know, these are stories we need to be telling. And so thank you so much for telling them.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Well, I'm so delighted, and so many fun things coming up. Thank you all for listening and spending some time learning more about women in all kinds of periods of time, specifically the anarchy, or the period called the anarchy. I guess it's not officially even the anarchy, but these two Matildas who literally changed and wrote history. So thank you everyone for participating. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. If I could ask a favor, if you could please subscribe wherever you're listening or watching on YouTube, maybe leave a comment, a rating, share with a friend. It means so much and helps so much. Another big thank you and big shout out to my patrons. I would love to hear from you what you would like to hear more about as we keep shaking up history together. Thank you.